Dr. Powell actually did a great job of setting up public engagement and really incorporating the community values. I think that's really such an important piece here. And I do want to both acknowledge but also really thank Barbara Fain, who again has helped us from the public engagement piece. Barbara, as well as another committee member, Donna Levin, who is at Massachusetts. She's legal counsel for the state of Massachusetts. We're on our committee, and she actually was very instrumental in the public engagement piece. And so some of these slides are actually very much adapted from the work that our group put together, but I do want to acknowledge the work both of Barbara as well as Donna. So again, I'm going to now segue into the last piece here, which is public engagement. So we went from this overall, what is a disaster, this 30,000-foot level introduction and what's the framework, a little bit more about state and local government and how state and local government really intersects, and now we've moved into ethics and really what are some of the considerations that would be happening at the bedside and how planners really need to be, there's a duty to plan, and now into public engagement. And so this is really an important last piece that we want to describe here. And so in the 2009 report, we really made the argument that the planning, but especially the implementation of crisis standards of care, was really going to involve engagement of two groups of people that aren't completely different. There is obviously a relationship. Provider stakeholders, folks that who might be at the bedside making decisions and or be part of the process of what decision making is happening, and also engaging the community or the public. And so that was the 2009 report. And what we did then in the 2012 report, and what was actually one of the asks, if you will, of the ASPR when they asked IOM to really reconvene the committee in 2011 into 2012, was to actually now take the theory of 2009 of engagement or public engagement and really to come up with some sort of toolkit that we could actually help folks so that they would not have to start afresh every time in their local communities or in their states, so that public engagement would be more of a defined roadmap of how to actually go about doing this. So our report was really stated the case for public engagement, provided a framework for defining what are those essential principles that are involved, and really, again, a user-friendly toolkit that would help folks at the state and local government, as well as other agencies. So what are the goals of public engagement? It's to inform community members about the potential need for crisis standards of care, so that folks who may not know what CSC is or crisis standards of care, what might happen in a crisis situation, to let them know what that actually is all about, but at the same time, as Dr. Powell mentioned, is to really receive the community perspectives so that the ultimate goal is to ensure that the guidelines that the planners are putting in place reflect the values of the community and the priorities of the community in that planning process. The essential principles are that what we ask and we recommend is that policymakers seek public input. And we actually believe that's a really important thing. Policymakers should seek public input. And this could happen for a variety of reasons. But we're also saying is that if you're going to do public engagement, you got to do it well. If you're going to do it poorly, don't do it. It's better actually not to do it. You're going to actually make it even worse for your community if you engage in public engagement without adequate support, adequate resources, without even the opportunity of thinking about how you're going to incorporate public engagement into your planning processes. That the participants that you bring to the table should represent the diversity of the community, and there's really a big piece in our toolkit about use of stipends, especially to reach underrepresented populations. That there's an opportunity for deliberation, that you're not necessarily achieving consensus, that you're really looking at folks really coming together and talking with each other. and that you're committed at the end of the day to consider those outputs, not necessarily that you will definitely utilize those outputs, but if you decide for whatever reason that you're not going to, that there's some transparency back to the group that you describe why you did not incorporate certain things, and then eventually your final policy deliberations or decisions, I should say, are shared back with the community. The benefits of community or public engagement are both short-term and long-term, and I think we can really think about these very, very easily in that there's greater visibility and awareness about that CSC guidelines, CSC activities might be going into place in the midst of a crisis. There was also a two-way street. We were really helping, asking that the folks that are actually in the local communities or the ones who might be involved in public health preparedness or emergency response efforts, that they would actually be at the table or be in the room or be involved in the process so they could actually share back with the folks in the room about what currently is happening, because you don't want to leave people really, you know, sort of struggling with, geez, in a crisis, these are very difficult concepts, in a crisis what would happen? Well, what are you doing now for me? And so you want to really describe that there are some ongoing planning efforts that are happening, and that really there's something that you can do as well, or our community together can do, and that there are preparedness efforts that we can all take on ourselves, so that you're really giving some tools back to the community. But then in the long term, again, that the policies that we as planners come up with, they reflect the community's values, and that you really have, again, some transparency in that process. So those were the benefits. Here are the challenges. Credibility of process. Convening participants who reflect the diversity of the community. Facilitating meaningful conversations about difficult topics. I had the fortune to be the lead facilitator for two of the sessions, the pilot sessions that we did in Massachusetts, which I'll describe in just a second here. And I tell you, it's actually hard work. Facilitating is very difficult. It's not something you just say, okay, go do it. We really thought that there should be some real pointers that we could give to people on how you select facilitators and what kinds of facilitating techniques could be used that would allow for planners to really do this successfully. Applying outputs to policymaking, again, it's about data. How do you take that data? How do you actually do something with the information that you gain from these public engagement sessions? But you also manage expectations so that if there are inputs that you're not going to be able to use, or as Dr. Powell mentioned, there are some things that are quote-unquote off the table because they're ethically way out there, that you go ahead and actually acknowledge those. And then again, you have the resources, especially at a time when you have competing public health priorities and many state and local health departments across the country are really struggling with the financial picture being the way it has been. So we came up with this toolkit, and the toolkit was really an opportunity to put forth community conversation, these tools that were based on not just something that we were doing in these two pilots in Boston and Lawrence, Massachusetts, but that they were really based on experiences of other jurisdictions. And so some of those jurisdictions include what our colleagues in Seattle King County have done, which they've done an incredible amount of work, and really ask you, if you haven't had a chance to look at some of their public engagement work, it's on the web, Google it, it's fantastic. Minnesota, state of Minnesota, has actually done quite a bit of public engagement activities, as well as what we in Harris County had done as well, where we had eight community engagement activities or public engagement activities and one stakeholder engagement activity, a session that we had done last summer. And actually there are two pictures here that I pulled, and again, my colleague is in the bottom right picture, Dr. Palacio. She is leading one of the public engagement sessions, as you can see there in the bottom right. Based on the summative work that we saw that was out there, we then engaged in two pilots One was in Boston at Harvard Medical School, so very academic setting. The other was a very community. It was a community center, if you will, in Lawrence, Massachusetts, away from the academia, away from the ivory tower, to really pilot some of these tools and techniques to see if they were effective and what we could do to help adapt them for state and local jurisdictions. And so our goal is to have this toolkit there so that folks in the room or folks that are out there doing this kind of work can tailor and adapt them to their needs. So what is in the toolkit? I guess the big question is that it includes tools for engaging the lay public on what are the values that underlie the allocation of resources in disasters. So we've got everything. We've got a sample agenda, we got content slides, facilitator script strategies, survey scenarios, data collection templates, survey questions, and this is where I say much, much more, but then I sound like a used car salesman, but I don't want to do that. But there's a lot in there. So really we ask you to really avail yourself if you're thinking about public engagement, how are we in our communities going to be able to do this? Please look at this toolkit because we really think it's going to help with laying the framework for how to actually go about doing this. But it also addresses important questions such as when do we do this? How do you engage community partners? How do you reflect the community's diversity? What's the appropriate length of public engagement sessions? How do you make the materials understandable? What are the skills and backgrounds for facilitators? What are we going to do with the data? How do we actually take the data and do something with it that's going to be meaningful? Is this research or is it deliberative democracy? And so that whole question about institutional review board type of IRB type of activities, and should this be reviewed by IRBs, et cetera, those are really some of the main issues that we have really tried to address, trying to anticipate some of the roadblocks that might be in store for communities that might be actually doing this. So here's a bouncing something that just came down. Well, we've come up with, in the toolkit, there's some sample scenarios. This is scenario one, which is a major earthquake. We actually come up with a script of really what we felt would be a way of describing the sort of no notice event, but there's also a deadly virus scenario as well, so for that slowly evolving event. And so again, scenarios that can be used. Here's again an example of scenario deliberations, and as Dr. Powell had mentioned, we were really talking about at some point vaccines and antivirals, but the real one that really gets very challenging is ventilators. And so when you look at ventilator activity or ventilator allocation, I should say, that's really where we really looked at, well, how do we go about doing some of these deliberations? And so in this case, you can see patients who need immediate treatment. You've got patient A through I. You've got ages that are all over the map. You got chance of survival that are low, medium, and high. And now you tell folks that are in the room, you've got only a limited number of ventilators at your disposal. How are you going to allocate? And so the real concept isn't necessarily about the specific ages or specific chance of survival, although I'll tell you, people really get into that. But it's really about moving the discussion forward and really allowing people to understand the complexity of the decision making and the allocation decisions that would be in place in this kind of a situation. And so then what we do is that we actually take the opportunity of having people who have now internally had some discussions or thought processes about how would I go about doing this, and then we go ahead and shake them up and put them in the small groups or what have you and have them discuss it with their neighbors, if you will, and then we ask them to actually vote, if you will. And we used, in the case of our pilots, the audience response system, the ARS. Anybody here familiar with those? You know those clickers, yeah. And so so that you really don't know what people in the what a specific person in the room is actually clicking, but you know the temperature of the room. You know what the general the feeling in the room is for certain certain kinds of principles. And so I'll just share very quickly. It's better to say the most lies, even if it means that some people won't get all the medical care they would get under normal conditions. Healthcare providers should be allowed to perform services different from their usual duties if that might save more patients, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very difficult concept as well. It's one thing to say, yeah, that sounds like a great concept, or I don't think that's a great concept. But then if you ask people, do you strongly agree? Do you agree, disagree, strongly disagree? And what we did actually in our pilots is we actually worked on figuring out when people come into the room, they don't have any information on crisis standards of care and what this is all about. You ask them to click right then. And then after they've had the opportunity to deliberate with both think about it, but also deliberate with their colleagues or other participants in the room, then you ask them to click again or re-vote, if you will. And the reason to do that is to actually see if there have been some changes along the spectrum now that people have a better idea about crisis standards of care work and some of those activities. So the take-home message is that public engagement should be embraced and not feared. I think this is really an important message that we want to make sure that's out there. A lot of times in the planning phase, we think about, geez, this is something that's going to be very difficult. I don't really understand it. I'm not sure how I'm going to do this in my community. And so we sort of tend not to do it then, or we tend to shy away from it, or we tend to move away from it and say, that's going to be something that I'm going to take on tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. As long as it's in the future, we're not quite there yet. But we really feel that public engagement, when done well, can give you tremendously rich and useful information, and that it really allows you to understand challenging concepts both as the planners but actually the public. So we don't give the public enough credit. So we think you're going to have all these lay people and put them in a room and you're going to, now they're going to start doing all this, they're going to throw tomatoes at us and do all sorts of things. But guess what? The public actually gets this stuff. And if nothing else, they're very thoughtful in their deliberation process. And that was reflected not just in the pilot projects that we did in Lawrence and in Boston, also in the projects, the public engagement projects that we did in Harris County. Also, there was a separate project that IOM also sponsored with antiviral distribution along with the CDC. There were also some three additional public engagement sessions that we did across the country. The public actually is quite deliberative, quite thoughtful, and actually gets very difficult concepts as long as you do these and you put these public engagement sessions on well. And they appreciate the fact that you've done that, that you actually have come to their communities and you have asked their opinions, and that there is an opportunity for them to be heard. And I think that's really a critical piece. As well as they want to hear what actually is happening on the ground and what planning and planners are actually doing. And so we really believe that the toolkit provides materials to help facilitate successful public engagement sessions. This is my contact information. That's a picture for after the Kashmir earthquake. That's True Chai. It's, I guess, you know, when you go to Starbucks and they have chai tea latte and they, you know, they say it's chai and tea, it's the same word twice. I never quite understood that, but this is actually somebody actually making chai on a true burner there. So that's my contact information. And in order to get any of these reports, you can certainly download them. Here's contact information for our study director, Dr. Bruce Altavoet. Please contact him as well. One thing that I failed to mention is that the way this report is actually designed is that it's separate modules, and so you can actually pull out one of the modules, if you will, that's on public engagement and look at that as a separate module. You can also pick up the one that's on EMS and give it to your EMS folks and as a separate module, or you can take the sum of all the modules and read it cover to cover, which I'm sure everybody in the room is going to do. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop. We have about 15 minutes, so we have plenty of time for questions. So, and again, I invite Barbara, if you wanted to come up and even share some insights from the public engagement piece, feel free to come on up. Yeah. Yes?
A couple of questions. In your presentation, it sounds yes. like there were really two communities of interest. One is the provider community, and the other is the more general public. Would providers have to agree to the revisions in how they provide care and making different decisions and all that? It wasn't really clear. Is there a separate set of tools on how to engage the provider community as opposed to tools for engaging the public community?
So the million-dollar question, I'll repeat it. So are there separate tools for the provider community in addition to the public engagement tools? That's right. So the million-dollar question, because we actually did not develop tools for the provider engagement. Now, certainly when you're doing engagement, we recognize that you may have healthcare personnel, and in fact, oftentimes you do, that may be a part of the process, that may actually be in the sessions, and oftentimes are going to contribute to the, you know, the deliberations and the discussions. But what we did not do was to actually, it was not part of the charge to come up with the actual provider engagement tools. Now, one of the things that we're really looking at and some of the discussions that we've had is that as we've moved forward and really disseminated the information about public engagement tools that are out there, we are recognizing and people are coming to us with that same question. Well, what about the providers? And so we're actually now thinking about how we might be able to better engage providers in the process and potentially down the road if there's some opportunities to develop some tools.
And I'll comment too, it's a particularly important question because I think that providers feel very disengaged in many cases from this kind of process. I think there are different professional societies within pieces of medicine and EMS who have gotten some distance along making up their own guidelines, and people within those groups may feel engaged. But I think there are a lot of providers out in the community, nurses, doctors, PAs, all sorts of people who feel very distanced from this, who feel like, I wouldn't know what to do, I wouldn't know where to go, I don't like those recommendations, what do I do here? So I think that remains a really important issue. There's a lot more work to do there that we need to do.
There actually has been provider engagement, on Chris's here, that done in various states, in Massachusetts and Minnesota, a couple of other places. Did you do? I don't think you did. So there actually are some tools out there if you're looking, but there is discussion about there and a recognition that you need really two sets of tools to do sort of before guidelines are actually finalized and adopted, and then afterwards, which is really about more training. So,
Yeah. Great question. Yes, in the back. You, yeah.
A couple of questions. Along with the provider issue, what about pre-providers? I work in a university where we have a strong interest in the student body, nursing, and social sciences, and we actually have a class that we're using. We have a PhD nurse who actually specializes in this, but we're struggling with the idea of standards of care. And also jurisdiction. If we respond in Tennessee to people in Georgia, what are the ethics, what are the legalities involved? So do you have crisis standards of care and engagement for pre-providers at the AS level, possibly at the BS level, but they're not really trained, the students aren't trained to actually go into in this disaster setting. The second question I had has to do with the idea of implementing this in a pre-disaster setting. You get the public engaged. Would you have the same response, or if you actually tried engaging the public that has already had a disaster, to see if they respond differently to your set of questions than those that were prior to the disaster?
Yeah, let me actually take a couple of parts of that question, and then I'll turn it over to Tia and Barbara if they want to add to it. I think that, so the first question was about pre-professional, have we been able to think about how those folks might actually be a part of the process? And I think you specifically referred to legal considerations as well. And so one thing that we've really done is to really think about the legal considerations that come into professionals and or volunteers, if you will, because in this case they may very well be volunteers unless they are licensed, if you know, it's just that sort of end level of getting the degree, volunteers that might actually be in the midst of a disaster or a crisis. And so we've got some specific recommendations that are very much about those legal considerations that are going to be in play. At the same time, we also recognize that when we look at engaging, again, and similar to the question that was just asked earlier, when we look at engaging folks very much as part of the process, that you are going to have really some movement of people that are going to be in the lay public or going to be in the healthcare group that may be coming forward and be interested and be ready to be part of that process and are going to have some very, very specific deliberations and unique perspectives. And so we recognize that, and yet at the same time we also recognize that it's a challenge when you have a situation where you don't, when folks may not have those end degrees, if you will, before they can actually respond.
One of the sections of the report, it's actually a pensum-bound, set of fines, looks at legal issues in particular. And one of the ironies is that in many states, including my state of New York, volunteers actually sometimes have better legal protection than people who are fully licensed in there. So there's kind of a what our colleague James Hodge calls a patchwork of legal and liability protections across the country that vary a lot state by state. But a lot of people are working that and working on that and trying to figure out what is the appropriate way of protecting people. The issue of pre-professionals is complicated and kind of leads into very complicated ethical and technical questions about how much beyond your settled area of expertise can you go in a disaster. It has particular resonance when we talk about international disasters, because frankly there are people who are sort of disaster junkies and they want to go abroad and do stuff that they could never do here. Similarly, in a disaster here, people who basically spend their lives doing something else think, that's great, now I get to feel like a neurosurgeon. But that's not actually ethically acceptable. It's not helpful. So one of the things that you have to do in a disaster is sometimes be able to tell people, no, thank you. Actually, we don't want you in the OR if you don't already know how to do that. And actually managing people who show up for disasters who don't have appropriate skills is a huge problem. So for students, they're familiar, they may know their way around the hospital, so there are things they can do. They shouldn't do things which they do not yet have the expertise to do. And it's actually quite an important thing, and people don't grasp that. There are appropriate ways to expand beyond care. If you're a floor nurse, and we don't have enough nurses for the ICU, usually in ICU, there's one ICU nurse for two beds. Well, you don't have enough people to do that in a disaster. So maybe you'll take one ICU nurse and have her supervise two floor nurses while they take care of patients in the ICU. That's okay. Right? That's a reasonable extension of your expertise and a reasonable way of doing that. You would not take a nursing student and have her, unless really there's nobody there at all, in which case you're better off to probably shut the ICU. You would not have a nursing student who's not comfortable in the ICU, doesn't know how to take care of somebody on a ventilator, taking care of ventilator patients without appropriate supervision on somebody taking care of them. You'll do more harm than good. So it's an important issue. It's not your willingness to be helpful is not sufficient in some of these cases.
I just wanted to add what you said, that it's not your willingness, but the training which is needed in time of crisis.
Yeah.
I just wanted to follow up on the question about provider engagement, that I think as Dr. Shah and Dr. Powell elucidated, I think it's important to remember what the goal, to set your goals in advance about engagement. Much of the public engagement that we're talking about is actually about reaching folks who don't usually have the channels to speak to power. And providers generally have other channels. Public engagement can be very resource intensive. It's not that I'm saying it's not important, but there are other avenues to gather that input, and there are folks who frequently have the status to put their input in, sure, even if you're not explicitly soliciting it. So I just wanted to. And since we tend to listen, I'm a physician, we tend to listen to life, just want to make sure that we are attuned to the principles of equity and trying to understand that this is to make sure that those folks who might not normally see themselves in the disaster paradigm have an opportunity to weigh in on how our plans play out for them, because they're folks from whom we're often very far removed.
Sure, and I want to just build on that, and that's why it's so important on the underrepresented communities, because you want to make sure you have diversity, because again, as was just described, you may have a situation where the majority of the community, if you will, may have some other avenues to be able to give their input, but the underrepresented communities may not have those opportunities, and so you want to make sure that you think about that as well. Let me just go in the back here, and then I'll...
Kind of a follow-up question.
Yes.
Are there other techniques that you highlight for the public engagement? Because those, focus groups, it's a small, very subset of the demographic. 4,000 people in a county minus 4 million, 9 million. Other avenues that you guys are advocating for that public engagement?
Absolutely. I'm going to... Barbara, do you want to...
Yeah, Again, it sort of depends on an understanding of what the goal is with public engagement, which is different than the goal of doing a survey, of a typical survey where you're trying to get results that you could potentially generalize to a larger population and be able to say, for instance, there is agreement that, or disagreement that, you know, for instance, elders should or shouldn't receive priority in a crisis. So I think the value of public engagement is that from a policymaker standpoint, and I come from my background working for the state of Massachusetts, is that what you get is sort of a richness of conversation, which doesn't mean you don't come out of it with a sense that there's even consensus within the room, because these are difficult issues. And I know there's disagreement in the theory about public engagement. There's some theorists who will say the goal is consensus. I personally don't agree with that, especially on an issue like this. So you're not looking for consensus, right? What you're looking for is a sense. Sometimes you find that the weight of opinion, and it can sometimes surprise you, is very strongly in one direction or another. Or you'll find that there are a couple of issues where there's a real split of opinion. So you'll know that, for instance, age is, you know, we've done enough surveying of this to know that age, you know, should age be a factor, age alone be a factor. We know that that there's disagreement. There's just, you know, there's a lot of disagreement about that. Same thing with healthcare providers and giving priority to healthcare providers. That's another one where we know that there's some disagreement. You also discover that there are areas where, sort of the hot button areas, where maybe you know, there are very strong opinions going in one direction, and you know as a policymaker you're not going to go in that direction, but you know that you need to educate the public. So it sort of flags the areas where you need to do more education, more explanation. So that's, I think, that's the value of public engagement. It is more laborious, as anyone who's done it knows, than doing a big survey. And I think there's some disagreement. I don't know on issues like this that you can do a traditional phone survey with nothing more, no prior education, just go ask the questions. Because we know from the public engagement that we've done, when you ask the questions at the beginning and some discussion, you ask them, there's change of opinion. Change goes sometimes in different directions, but people, you know, without information, once they have information and an opportunity to deliberate, people's views about this change. So I'm not sure what the value is of doing a broad-based survey on issues like this. So there are trade-offs with public engagement, and so you're not going to be able to say as a policymaker, you know, this is what the public thinks. It's, you know, it's really not about.
But we do definitely have some tools that will help in looking at how do you engage in certain, you know, certain populations. The other thing I also just remind you is that there are, it's a summative piece of work, so it also refers to some other activities that happen in other parts of the country. So also you may want to look at what Seattle King County may have done, or Harris County may have done, or Minnesota may have done, or public engagement sessions that have been in public health preparedness have been done in other areas. So great question. We're right at 4 o'clock. In fact, we're 4:01. I'm going to do one quick question. We're going to do one quick response, and we're going to stop. So who wants that last one quick question? Burning, who's got it? Okay, in the back. All right, you were more enthusiastic. Sure.
About how they look at the care they would get from their hospitals, from their first responders who would reach changing, and they need to understand that so that they can be partners in that change. That's not a one-off, that's a process. Mm-hmm. So does the toolkit describe how the county or local institutions carry on that dialogue?
Yeah, so very quickly, so the toolkit is recognizes that this is a process, and the process really requires that folks are trusted and credible planners in the community. And so you can't just have let's say, a history of not being trusted and then show up and say, hey, I'm here to engage you, and then go away. And so it recognizes that this is really an ongoing process. And so, yes, absolutely. And yet, at the same time, there are limited resources, and so you have to weigh then how many of these kinds of sessions you may be able to do, and what kinds of resources are you going to be able to put toward this kind of a process. So it's really a back and forth. So great question. So with that, we're going to be here for a few minutes. I want to thank Dr. Powell, Dr. Hanfling, and in absentia, Barbara Fain, who was able to come up here, all of you for being here, and thank you very much, and please look at the report if you've not had a chance.
Thank you.